Hi everybody, I'm Greg. I normally practice with the Sunday group for the most part. It's hard for me to make a Tuesday night, so I think I've met most of you, but if I look unfamiliar to any of you, that's why. I do watch all the videos from all the Tuesday classes, so all of you look familiar to me. But if you're not sure who I am, I'm usually just around on Sundays. I've been traveling for the last couple of weeks, so after I signed up to give this talk, I kind of just planned it right away because I knew I wouldn't have a lot of time to plan it in advance. And with knowing how poor my memory is, I knew I wouldn't remember anything that I planned. So I wrote it all down. So I'm going to be kind of looking this way a little and just reading to you what I wrote several weeks ago on the 10th grave precept of not killing. So here we go. I'm not going to cite everything that I say, but I should mention that I borrowed heavily from Nancy Mujo Baker's book on the precepts, Opening to Oneness, and John Dido Laurie's book, The Heart of Being. I had a huge pile of precept books on my desk while writing, but those are my two favorite books on the precepts, at least this year. So I drew heavily from both of them, as well, of course, on Domio's teachings. It's hard to say where Domio's, Mujo's, and Dido's ideas end and where mine start, because they've also deeply influenced my understanding of this topic. I know the required reading for this talk was chapter 12 of Diane Eshin Rosetto's Waking Up to What You Do. I have reread that chapter in preparation for this talk, but presumably so have all of you. So you shouldn't need me to summarize it, and I'm not going to. I feel like I could field questions on it if they come up, though. I'll do my best at least. Today we'll be moving on from where Leah left off with the three refuges and the three precept, pure precepts, and discussing the first of the 10 grave precepts, which can be put as non-killing, not killing, no killing, non-violence, affirming life, cultivating life, encouraging life, giving life, cultivating peace, refraining from harm, whatever floats your boat. There are convincing arguments for using any of those terms. Our chant book defines the first grave precept in this way: do not kill, cultivate and encourage life. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. The life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. Continue the life of the Buddha. Do not kill the Buddha. I used to like to say that the precepts are descriptive, not prescriptive. Lately, though, I think they fall somewhere in between those two terms. What I mean by prescriptive is the thou shalt not of it all. And by descriptive, I mean the precepts are just examples of how a bodhisattva behaves. If you're enlightened, there's no other way to live than by the precepts. So the precepts just describe bodhisattva activity. They don't dictate it or prescribe rules of how to behave. Zen's concept of the middle way and its focus on non-dualism, however, puts our relationship with these precepts somewhere in between those two concepts, or even forces us to vacillate between these two realities based on the circumstances, or better yet, the causes and conditions of any particular moment in time and space. Some of us raised in the Judeo-Christian faiths are very familiar with the Ten Commandments. These are a prescription for morality. It's right there in the name. God commands their followers to behave in this way, and if you don't, you'll have fire and brimstone to reckon with. But Buddhism follows a method of no method, right? We don't necessarily aim to follow the precepts. We take a more descriptive approach to morality. As Dogen tells us in Fukan Zazengi, practice realization is naturally undefiled. And the thing that we realize through this naturally undefiled practice is that we are all interconnected. We learn there are karmic repercussions for our actions, but not necessarily a direct punishment. We either act morally or we don't, and that's just how it is. We're realized or we aren't. In Hinduism and Buddhism, the belief that all things are interconnected, co-arising, and sharing mutual causality is often contextualized using the metaphor of Indra's net. This metaphor describes this interrelationality of all things as a net that covers the entire universe, on which every connection, every point where the twine crosses another piece of twine to make up the mesh of the net, is a multifaceted diamond reflecting every other diamond on every other connection. One diamond cannot be affected by any individual cause or condition, without every other diamond on this universe-sized net also being affected by that very same cause or condition. By taking the precepts, we acknowledge that we are one of those diamonds on the net, and we are vowing not to reflect any more negative causes onto the other diamonds than we can help. We're vowing to become one with the Buddha, with the Dharma, and with the Sangha. That is, we acknowledge that we are one with everything, and we vow to behave as such. John Dido Laurie says, "To be a Buddha is to not separate yourself from others anytime, any place." So someone who recognizes their interbeing with all things, ideas, actions, objects, and sentient beings, cannot possibly be immoral because they are behaving as a Buddha, and Buddhas do not behave immorally. When we take the precepts, we become one with the Buddha, and this interpenetration with the Buddha results in conduct that's naturally undefiled, to reiterate Dogen's statement. So our ability to follow or break a precept, or not taking an opportunity to kill something, is not so much a sign that we're moral people, but a measure of the progress of our practice. Nancy Mujo Baker puts it this way: the Zen precepts are not thought of as having been developed by human beings as a way of managing our social and moral interactions, but rather as being revealed to Shakyamuni Buddha as intrinsic to the enlightened reality to which he awakened. She's saying, we don't follow or break precepts. We are either separated or non-separated from them. We are either at one with the precepts or any given precept, or we are not. When we recognize we are at one with everything, the precepts describe our activity. They don't dictate it. And being one with the precepts is having them arise naturally and is a sign of, at least in that moment, enlightenment. Where this gets really interesting is when we recognize the causes and conditions of our lives are deeply intertwined with everyone else's, then we are at one with everything, including the precepts. We alone cannot kill anyone if we are not separate from them, because then we die too. And if we do kill something, aren't others somehow implicated in that killing too, since we are all interconnected? Who really killed who? Who is the killer and who is the victim? I may have taken your life, but I definitely lost some of my own in the process. Who is the person that took that from me? When we truly understand that we are all interdependent, the thought of killing another being separate from any of the precepts never occurs to us. When we are able to conceptualize interbeing, it becomes impossible to break a precept. It is impossible to kill anything or anyone. So this brings us to the Zen peacemaker's definition of the first grade precept. Recognizing that I am not separate from all that is, this is the precept of non-killing. But unfortunately, we cannot live in our head with our head in the clouds of the absolute all the time. This descriptive aspect of the precept is only part of the story, especially when this precept stuff is all new to us. Sometimes in the relative world, the first grade precept does take on a more prescriptive nature. It can be very literal, non-killing, okay. I will not eat that delicious looking meatball because I have so many other plant-based options to choose from. Easy. Or maybe we have to take on a more relative approach, like there is nothing available to eat but meatballs, and I will kill myself if I don't eat that dead cow. So yes, all things are interconnected, but I need to make conscious judgments about the fact that I'm starving right now, right here in the real world, not in some idealized world where I know intellectually that it's wrong to kill animals, or some absolute world where there's no separation between the killer and the killed. In her book on the precepts opening to oneness, Nancy Mujo Baker makes the same distinction in viewing all of the precepts, including the first one, the first grade one, on these three levels: the literal level, the relative level, and the absolute level. The literal level takes the precept at face value. It interprets the language literally. Do not kill. Cultivate and encourage life means, under no circumstance, kill any creature and foster the lives of all living things. But on the relative level, though, we are challenged to acknowledge the inevitability of killing. I can't walk through this world without stepping on at least one ant, without my immune system attacking germs and viruses that try to invade my body, without interpreting the word kill figuratively, and then going ahead and killing time by writing poetry about it that no one will ever read. At the absolute level, we see the non-killing more from the prescriptive point of view. I'm ordained into my life, and I have become one with the Buddha. It's not possible for me to kill. Even though Mujo Baker calls these levels, we do not necessarily ascend from one level to the next. It's not a series of steps we go through from the literal to the relative and then ultimately to the absolute. We all take all of these approaches to killing all at once, or we may even vacillate between them from moment to moment. So let's talk about each of these levels with respect to killing. At the literal or ideal or conventional, we might even say linguistic level, we're essentially just defining the concepts of killing, taking life and affirming life at their face values. It's as if we're in a vacuum. We're analyzing all the things that life and death can look like from a theoretical point of view, where nothing really is at risk of dying in this moment, right here and now. We're simply trying to understand the precept of non-killing. This is where Dogen's definition of the first great precept comes in. It goes like this: the Buddha seed grows in accordance with not taking life. Transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom and do not kill. This is a rare case where Dogen's words are germane to a discussion on speaking literally. He's telling us here, plain and simple, don't kill stuff. And while you're at it, help other people live a good life. It's that easy to follow this precept. But is it that simple? It's easier said than done, right? Okay, I won't eat meat or buy leather, but what if I see a used pair of leather boots in a thrift shop? That money's not supporting the industry that produces those boots. It doesn't lead to more cows being turned into boots. It supports the charity that runs the thrift shop. Well, okay, that's complicated. I won't wear or eat animal products, so I'll just grow my own fruits and vegetables. But aren't vegetables alive too? And now the aphids are eating all my peaches, but I can't use pesticides. So should I release these ladybugs I bought at the gardening store to eat the aphids? That's just the circle of life, right? Okay, I'll leave the aphids alone and just buy peaches from the store. Surely no animals die producing the organic peaches they sell in the co-op, and no bugs hit the windshield of the truck delivering them, and no rodents were killed in the traps in the store where I bought them. And again, aren't peaches alive too? So, okay, fruit's pretty complicated. Let me put that on the back burner and think about my job instead. It's easy not to kill when I'm doing my job. Maybe I spent my whole life, my whole childhood wanting to do good for the world and devoted all of my life and energy preparing to help people. Maybe I wanted to become a doctor, a nurse, a politician, a police officer, a firefighter, a soldier, a truck driver, or a pilot. All of these professionals make the world a safer and easier place to live. They bring us the things we need, protect us from threats, and they escort us away from danger while they're often running headlong into it. But one tiny, well-intentioned misjudgment or mistake by any one of these helpers can lead to a person's death. It could even lead to a lot of people's deaths. And when it does, do we accept these mistakes as the inevitable actions of a hero who puts themselves into the fray for our benefit, but is only human? Or do we vilify them as killers? It depends on the circumstances. It depends on the causes and conditions of every single moment leading up to that incident. Suddenly, it becomes very hard for us to take this precept literally, and we find ourselves facing the relative level of the first great precept. This is where things get really messy. On the relative or actual or dependent level, context is important. This is the realm of everyday morality and ethics. Sometimes killing can even be the right thing to do. Where do I stand on assisted suicide? Would I go back in time and shoot Hitler as a baby? Are eggs meat? If I push someone out of the way of a bullet and get myself shot instead, did I break this precept? What if neither of us dies? What if we both do? What if I kill someone's spirit? What if I kill time? What if I kill the lights? Do these ambiguous and metaphorical interpretations of killing break the first precept? Well, it depends on you. Do you feel they separate you from others, or do they deepen your connections? When we bring the literal idea of killing into the real world, the relative world, where everything is interconnected, where we're all tangled up in Indra's net, things start to seem less obvious than they did when we were thinking of killing on a literal, ideal, theoretical level. Since karma is the result of cause and effect, we need to consider which cause or causes led to any given effect. There are potentially millions of causes happening in every moment that can lead to any particular event, and millions more in the moment that preceded it, and more in the moment before that. How many of those millions of causes do we actually have any control over, and how many are we even responsible for? So, anytime we encounter any situation where the precepts become relevant, how we break or follow them has to be viewed on a case-by-case basis. In the relative dependent world, nothing is as black and white as it was when we were defining the precept on that literal level. And my right or appropriate response to this situation could be completely different from yours, even if you're standing right next to me, because our karmas are different. Different causes and conditions brought us all to this moment right now that we're all in right now, and so our responses are different. I volunteered to give this talk, so the best way for me to practice non-killing in this moment is to talk about it right now. You decided to come into the dirt zendo or log into the cloud zendo, so the best way for you to practice non-killing in this moment is to listen to what I'm saying and to determine whether or not it fits in with your individual karma. Same moment, but your upaya or skillful means looks different than mine does. So it's horrible to kill things, but it's all relative. What does this moment dictate for you right now? This is your first time studying the precepts, I'm going to level with you. These vows are impossible. All vows are impossible, especially the Zen vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Give me a break. You cannot go through this world without breaking the precepts, and especially without killing anything. We kill things literally and fi figuratively every single day, possibly every moment. At least those of us in unenlightened mortals spending most of their time trudging through this relative dependent world. So what do? We do our best and we stick to our practice. We sit zazen to cultivate the mindfulness to pay attention. We study the Dharma to understand what moral living looks like. And we recognize our oneness with the Sangha, not just those people sitting next to us right now, but every living thing in the universe, everything in the universe. We practice, practice, practice in order to be able to meet every moment with mindfulness and skillful means. But we'll still screw it up. We'll still kill something. We're all bulls in china shops, no matter how much we meditate. I recently heard a recording of a talk by Kyogen Carlson in which he related a story from a friend of his who practices in the Theravadan tradition. She shared a story about a retreat she attended where the monastery was overrun with cockroaches. The monks were following the first grave precept very literally, and their rigid adherence to the precepts informed their solution to the problem, which entailed lay followers taking each cockroach out of the monastery one by one and releasing them off the grounds. Obviously, this was not working. The last straw was when she saw the cockroaches crawling all over the monk's food. So she decided someone needed to take action, or the monks were going to end up eating all this contaminated food. She called a local exterminator, gave them her credit card number, telling them to charge her for the work, and headed home as the retreat ended. She told the monks as she was leaving, quote, "I realize this is breaking the first precept, but I'll take the karma for this. You don't have to worry about it. I'll accept this karma knowing that I'll also be protecting you all from eating contaminated food. You can cancel it if you like, but the appointment has been made and the work will be paid for, so do what you must." The next time she returned to that monastery, her teacher there thanked her and gave a Dharma talk on the importance of engaging with these precepts. It's not enough to learn their meaning and try not to break them. The whole point of these precepts is to engage with them here in the relative world and to see what you can learn by breaking and by following them. And if your killing further connects you to the people in your life, did you even break the precept? Karma is created without our direct input all the time. And we're going to be forced to act over and over again. The way we develop the upaya or the skillful means to be moral, upright human beings is to recognize that we're not always going to know what to do. But if we take some time when it's available to bear witness to the consequences of a monastery overrun with cockroaches, then we may come to understand the only thing we can do is to take action. And the action we must take is to break a precept and resolve some karma in the universe that we didn't even put there. And that may lead us to take on some pretty bad karma of our own, but maybe it's for the greater good. We're forced to act in this life, and the right action may not always be obvious to us. So the best we can do is try our best and put good karma out there. And if we screw up, then to take some time to atone. The Kyoju Kaiman, which is the ceremony during which we take the precepts, as you all know, starts with the Gatha of Atonement or the Karma verse for a good reason. Paul Simon has a lyric that goes, "You cannot walk with the holy if you're just a halfway decent man." We have to atone for our past killings before we can vow not to kill again, because we need the practice for when we break the vow and kill again. Every human kills every day. What makes us Buddhists different is that we atone for it. We take responsibility. We make amends, and we are mindful to be more careful about killing in the future. Since I took this precept, I stopped wearing headphones while I mow my lawn. Prior to starting the lawnmower, I recite the Gatha of Atonement, all harmful karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, now I atone for it all. Then I start the lawnmower and I breathe and I mow. And since I'm not listening to music, I'm pretty alert and mindful. And from time to time, I catch my mind wandering and I recite the karma verse again. By doing this, I mow my lawn as mindfully as I'm able to, and I run over a lot fewer snails than I used to. I have to stop a lot because now I notice them. I'm compelled, now that I notice them, I'm compelled to stop the mower, walk in front of it, and rescue every snail. I also learn to mow at the hotter parts of the day, which is more uncomfortable for me, but there are fewer snails about when the sun has dried the dew on the grass. Do I still kill things every time I mow the lawn? Yeah, tons of stuff, probably. Do I need to mow my lawn? No, but I take on the karma of killing microscopic organisms to be a considerate neighbor and to avoid breaking other precepts. We all are forced to take action in this world, and no matter how well-intentioned, precepts will be broken. So I recite another karma verse when I put the mower away, and I can tell you honestly, I sincerely mean every word of it. Our great-great Dharma grandfather, Kato Chisan Koho Zenji, said in his book, Soto Zen, we must incessantly practice serene reflection meditation, or shikantaza, and come to see that we are not the Buddha, but there is nothing in us that is separate or apart from the original Buddha. The ability to see our own shortcomings and errors is termed confession and contrition. Although we feel that any breakage of the precepts is a loathsome thing, we may say that there is nothing quite so beautiful as a former error which is repented. This urge to honestly look at one's shortcomings first arises as a result of deep faith. So, once the precepts are introduced into our practice, this unusual phenomenon sometimes occurs. Those of you who have already taken the precepts may have noticed that you sometimes feel worse about breaking a precept than about the result of the precept being broken. That is, by adding this artificial layer we call the precepts, we have to be careful that we do not create a condition where we may feel worse about breaking the precept of killing than we feel about something now being dead. This is a very selfish approach to morality that clearly separates us deeply, not only from other people, but from reality itself. This is not the point of the precepts. And let's just say we do feel bad that something is dead and that it's our fault. To now also feel regret over our unskillful action of breaking the first great precept would be akin to shooting ourselves with that proverbial second arrow. So, with atonement for the unskillful action, we remind ourselves of the causes and conditions that brought us to this terrible moment, rather than wasting our time, killing our time, feeling guilty about breaking a precept. Atonement draws our precept to the real problem. We just killed something. Who cares if we broke a precept? This is so much worse. So by acknowledging this, we can then view this incident as a Dharma gate rather than as a personal failure and use it to learn to put better karma into the universe going forward, since that is the only direction we can go. In his books, John Dido Laurie spells out the word atonement, ATONEMENT, at one mint. I don't know that there's an etymological basis for this, but I do know he's right to do this. By owning up to our mistakes, we are acknowledging that there are consequences to our actions, whether we intend them or not, and that we are set and that we are not separate from anyone or anything. When we atone, we are in a state of being at one. We are reminding ourselves that we are all one and that we have to try harder to cultivate mindfulness and skillful means in order to take as few lives and to affirm as many lives as possible. It's my belief that all 16 of the precepts can be condensed into two words, try harder, at least on the literal and relative levels. So, how about this absolute, ultimate, or independent level of the first great precept? This is the realm of oneness I described when I was talking about the descriptive nature of the precepts. It's the non-dual spiritual level. Here, the duality of right and wrong and following versus breaking a precept are irrelevant because here in the absolute, there is no duality and morality just is. It's all a part of interbeing. We are one with morality and with the precepts, and they are one with us. The precepts are simply intrinsic to enlightenment. And our practice is enlightenment. There is no separation between the one who acts and the precept. The precepts are not separate from themselves, from us, from our practice, from our zazen, the dharma, the lineage, the Buddha. They are all the same interpenetrating, codependently arisen thing. Nancy Mujo Baker shares numerous co quotes from thinkers across faiths expressing this point. Here are just a few. Dogen, in Zazen, what precept is not observed? Confucius, at 70, I could follow what my heart desired without transgressing what was right. The Christian poet Angelus Silesius, man, if you live in God and die to your own will, how simple it will be his precepts to fulfill. In Waking Up to What You Do, Diane Eshin-Rosetto introduces the concept of the dead spot. She recalls an interview with a trapeze artist who describes the dead spot as the place between swings when the trapeze bar that the swinger is swinging on comes to a stop just before it starts to move back in the opposite direction. That rather than cultivating great physical strength, the trapeze artist needs to master time in order to allow the energy of the trapeze to do the work for you. You use the change in momentum to create the next trick. And if you hesitate, you miss your opportunity, or you go for it and you don't land the trick, and very bad things happen. It is this brief moment of not knowing and non-action where you must make a decision that everything could depend on. These dead spots come up throughout our lives. Sometimes we recognize them, sometimes we don't. Sometimes there are cockroaches on the food. Sometimes a snail is in front of the lawnmower. Sometimes all there is to eat are meatballs. Sometimes we really just want those boots. These are dead spots. These are opportunities to practice with the precepts. Sometimes we'll take a very conscious, very literal approach and not take any path that leads to killing. Sometimes we'll consider all the causes and conditions that brought us to this point and make a decision based on weighing all the evidence. Sometimes that will take too long and we'll blow the trick and miss our chance to engage with the precepts at all, finding ourselves stuck in the dead spot. Are you killing yourself if an action prevents you from ever leaving the dead spot? Sometimes, though, the right action simply arises from the flow of the trapeze act. We are just so deeply in it that we don't have to do anything but act. Let the karma fall where it may. We're ordained into our lives. We're in the flow state. We have to do what we have to do, and all we can really do is something, anything. Here we are in the absolute level. Our practice has prepared us for this. Our zazen keeps us focused. Our dharma study built an arsenal of skillful means to keep at our disposal. And our sangha gave us the confidence to know we can act without transgressing what is right. In zazen, we are rehearsing the dead point over and over again, training our minds to be mindful enough and skillful enough to produce right action in response to a stimulus without conscious effort. Anytime we bump up against a precept, the skillful means we have cultivated through our practice kicks in, and we naturally behave in a moral way, in accordance with the precepts, without trying or thinking about it. We are at one with the precepts at the absolute level. We do this all the time, and I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for it. We're so quick to get down on ourselves every time we catch ourselves breaking a precept, but we barely notice all the times we just act morally without even thinking about it or even trying to, even though this is the key to non-separation in your being. Not only is this evidence that we can be in both the absolute and the relative dimensions of reality at the same time, but this is also the whole point of Zen practice. We don't always kill stuff all the time. How awesome is that? Here's where Bodhidharma's definition of the first precept hits a nerve. He says, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing. So there's the good news, but I'm going to bring the mood down again. Killing spreads like a disease, and because of Indra's net, we may all be complicit in killing we didn't even know about. There was an article in the New York Times a few years back that really stuck with me. I think of it whenever I think of the first precept. The title of the article is "The Unseen Scars of Those Who Kill Via Remote Control." The article is about an Air Force MQ-9 Reaper drone pilot named Captain Kevin Larson out of Creech Air Force Base, just north of Las Vegas. Captain Larson piloted over 650 combat missions overseas without ever leaving his desk north of Sin City. The targets in these missions were called in by numerous government agencies, and the rationale for these missions was often above the captain's security clearance. In the time he ran these sorties against the Islamic State and during the war with Afghanistan, collateral damage procedures were loosened considerably by Barack Obama and knowingly continued by Donald Trump. It would be dishonest if I didn't point out that this was a bipartisan effort. These actions led to the death of many civilians, including women, children, and passersby. One of the most disturbing of these incidents included a strike that killed every guest of a funeral for an Al-Qaeda operative that Captain Larson also killed during an earlier mission. Because drone operators do not need to enter a physical war zone to carry out these operations, Captain Larson's file simply listed the word "none" under combat service. Drone crews like his were treated like office workers, despite the toll that leading 650 combat missions against human targets could take on the human being pulling those triggers. Drone pilots do not receive the same recovery periods or mental health screenings that fighter pilots who physically enter the battlefield receive. And as a result, divorce, alcoholism, drug addiction, and suicide are commonplace among the troops who pilot aircraft remotely. Additionally, while fighter and bomber pilots may spend a few minutes over their target, drone crews spend from days to months surveilling their targets, sometimes observing them, eating with their families, taking their parents to the doctor, playing with their children, feeding their pets, attending religious services, and more before they ever pull the trigger that ends their target's lives. One drone operator interviewed in the article described having to watch. Sorry. One drone operator interviewed in the article described having to watch his target's children and pick up his body parts following the strike he had just led before going home to have dinner with his own children. So it should come as no surprise at this point in the story that the suffering induced by exacting so much death in such personal situations led Captain Larson to break down and start using psilocybin and MDMA to treat his own trauma, and then to share these drugs with other drone crew members who were similarly experiencing that same suffering. He was caught, charged with using and distributing controlled substances, stripped of his flight status, had his marriage fall apart, and he was put on trial, facing 20 years in prison. Because he was not a conventional combat veteran, the effects of his service had on his actions were not admissible in court, and he was convicted. He was not screened for PTSD at any point in this process. During the court recess between his conviction and his sentencing, Captain Larson got in his car and sped away from the courthouse. His Jeep was spotted by the police in Northern California, and a high-speed chase ensued, during which Captain Larson found himself at the end of a dead-end road in a canyon with the police right behind him. The police were informed the driver of the Jeep was a deserter who had just fled a drug conviction and may be armed and dangerous. Ironically, once that he was on foot, several small police drones were used to locate his position. At the sound of those drones, Captain Kevin Larson left a voicemail for his loved ones on his phone and took his last life, his own. So who are the killers in this story? Is it the targets of these missions who committed such heinous acts that Captain Larson was ordered to kill them? The agencies that ordered the missions? Was it the moral values of his targets that led them to become fighters for a cause that they believed in? Was it Larson's own values? Was it the parents who instilled them in him? Was it their parents, their teachers, their preachers? Was it the manufacturers of the drones, the ammunition, the gun Captain Larson used to kill himself? Was it the workers at the electric company that kept the power on in the building where the captain's computer was located? Was it the men who built the Hoover Dam that generated the power almost 100 years ago? The water that turns its turbines? Was it the two presidents from both major political parties who knowingly allowed for the increase in the number of drone missions against the Islamic State and the decrease in the collateral damage regulations protecting civilians from US attacks? Was it every American voter who voted for one or both of those presidents? Was it the Air Force chaplains and psychologists who didn't provide enough mental health services to the drone crews leading these types of missions? Or the policymakers who didn't think to order or fund these services? The office drone who wrote none under combat service on Captain Larson's records? Larson himself, the jury at his trial, the person who sold him the Jeep he escaped in, the dispatcher who told the police in his pursuit that he was a military deserter escaping a drug conviction? The manufacturer of the drones whose sounds led Captain Carson Larson to take his own life? The manufacturer of the bullet he took it with? All of these people who wouldn't be connected otherwise are all connected by all of the seemingly inevitable killing. Killing for which it's hard to find any one person to blame. Indra's net is vast and tangled like a web. Are any of these people guilty of anything other than just doing their jobs or following their civic responsibilities in the best way they could muster in this difficult, complicated, and confusing life? Someone has to take action and do the things that need to get done in the world that our ancestors left us and with the karma those ancestors created for us. Someone has to take up that karma because the causes and conditions have already been set into motion, and each of the people involved in this story just found themselves unwittingly mixed up in it, most likely with the very best of intentions. What else could they have done? What would you have done differently in any one of those roles? And what can those still living do now? Is atonement enough? Is it even necessary? Who atones here, and for what do they atone? Only each of the individual people involved in the story can answer these questions. And they can only answer them for themselves and the small role that they played in a much bigger picture. But because of Indra's net, aren't we all complicit in this tragedy? Who is the killer here? It feels to me like it might be all of us. But maybe we can beat this. We don't have to keep putting karma out there that leads to such tragic ends. We don't have to live in that world. Indra's net also shows us that we can fill the world with causes and conditions that do not lead to such violence, heartache, and death. The way all of us right here can do that is by practicing. Sometimes we will need to follow these precepts on the literal level, but usually it will get more messy than that. And we'll have to take a case-by-case approach on the relative level. But if we just keep practicing and sitting and engaging in bodhisattva activity and just doing the work that reflects the absolute level, if we just try harder, then the light of the absolute might ultimately get bright enough to overshadow the greed, hate, and ignorance that keeps bouncing from one diamond to the on the net to the next. It's easy to think of the precepts as a list of commandments that bind us to a restrictive set of rules and regulations. But our state of interconnectedness shows us that leading a life that allows the precepts to arise naturally at crucial decision points in our experience is what will ultimately free us. Not just from all this killing, but from all of the consequences of greed, hate, and ignorance, from all this endless suffering. I'd like to leave you with a quote from John Dido Laurie. He says we should not view the precepts as, quote, something restricting our life, but rather as a doorway to freedom. They are not meant to bind. They are not meant to limit. They are meant to liberate us. What binds us are the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance. What the precepts are about is wisdom, compassion, and realization, the other side of the three poisons. To practice the precepts is to be at harmony with your life and with the universe. Anybody have questions, comments, critiques? Going to ask you questions if you don't.
Kinwin has a question there. Go ahead.
No, that was just the clap emoji.
Oh, I see.
That was very well done, Greg. And you know, I'm a new guy here. This is my first night, but that was very compelling. So thank you for sharing that, especially the story.
Thanks. Welcome, Kevin. It's good to have you here. Yeah, AJ.
Yeah, first of all, Greg, thanks for speaking tonight. Really enjoy your perspective and the amount of research that went into this. And I really like the story you shared, about the drone pilot. So as a veteran myself, and that's something I struggle with a lot is the entanglement of even maybe not having been in direct combat but still being part of missions and operations that had outcomes that maybe aren't in alignment with the precepts, and something I have struggled with for a long time. And I think understanding the entanglement piece and the perspective of atonement and work to do better, I think is what I'm working on now. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thanks, AJ. Thanks for your service. I'm a veteran too, so I feel where you're coming from. I wasn't in a lot of direct combat roles either, but you know the work that you're doing is used in combat by other people, and there's a lot of atonement that comes out of that. There's a lot of I was in the Air Force for 4 years, and I feel like I've spent the rest of my life just finding ways to put myself in service to other people as a way to balance the scales. I still don't feel like I've done it. It's a hard thing to reckon with. Oh, go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I brought this up last week, but the compassion that I keep in mind when I'm busy following my habit energy of doing my life and then realizing I'm breaking a precept because, as you say, Greg, it is happens. And if you claim you're walking along, you're not touching the ground, being perfect and not breaking precepts because you're not aware. So awareness is the first point of turning, but also the compassion that you show toward yourself. is so important. At least it's crucial to me. It's really a central point for me where I engage with the precepts, and how I engage with the precepts is the first step for me is to say, don't beat yourself up, Leah. And it's going to be okay because you notice now. And that's the first part is that I've noticed. So, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel like since I started sitting Zazen daily, I notice this stuff more. Those dead spots become much more obvious. And sometimes the response to those dead spots just kind of happens. Like it's almost like the precepts are following themselves sometimes. And that doesn't happen all the time, but it's pretty cool to see when it does. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but I see someone in the dirt tender. You guys are muted.
There we go. This is Percy. I'm usually here on Tuesdays. I'm relatively new still, so I just mainly just wanted to thank you for what you wrote. It was very mindful, and as a person that is new to the practice and the precepts, it's been incredibly helpful for me to hear. And the only other thing I wanted to say is, I want to encourage you to publish it. I really think that you should, that the world needs to hear what brilliant minds like yours have to say on this. I think you should. That's all. Thank you.
Really kind, thank you.
Hi everybody, this is Jeff. I too want to add my thanks, Greg. I thought that was a brilliant overview of that precept. And this moment we're sharing together feels very quiet to me because I feel personally very busy processing all of the things that you touched on that were so valuable and thoughtful. I really appreciate your service, Senwin and Greg, and my heart goes out to you as I imagine your reflections on the things you're trying to process. And maybe all of us can relate a little bit as we've lived our life and think about things that we need to process and atone for. And I also feel, while you gave us a lot to think about, Greg, that you came back to this concept of compassion, and that maybe we can have that for each other. I feel that in your talk. I feel that encouragement, and I'm encouraged that both of you could share that little bit about your past, Senwin and Greg, because maybe as a Sangha we can compassionately and lovingly embrace you and help you and help each other with that journey we're all on. So thank you.
Yeah, Kenwin points out that that was AJ, but Kenwin is also a veteran. He appreciates those words.
Ruth Ann, did you have something?
Oh, briefly, yes, Greg, this was humbling, which is good for all of us to be and to hear your good report, and actually a reminder that Buddhism isn't for wimps. I mean, if you receive the precepts. Thank you.
Then. So I have a question. I'm kind of curious who's taking Jukai this year. CJ. Maybe John. In the dirt, is there anyone? I can't see how far Charles you're taking. I see a kind of a shadow of a hand in the back of the room in the dirt.
So Scott and Jill, perhaps?
Okay.
She'll say okay.
So yeah, the reason I asked, we've got a couple more minutes. I was just wondering if any of those of you who are taking Jukai have any like worries about it or anxiety, or does it feel like a strong commitment or something that is too hard?
Scott here, Greg.
Hi.
No, actually, hearing Leia last week and yourself this week, and I can't remember who spoke 3 weeks ago.
Tyler.
Who was it?
Tyler.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, what all of you have been presenting, is there any way you can share that with us? Because I think it would be great. To be able to read it and have it for more reflection and for more nourishment. And by the way, I didn't know there was required reading for. Like, what required reading?
I'm not sure that's required, but every year there's a book that's recommended in the CI.
Okay.
I'll show you. It's this book here, Waking Up to What You Do. It has a sunflower on it,
Okay.
but it's on Amazon.
Yeah, but again, just a request, at least for my benefit, it would be very helpful if any of that can be shared, because I'm very visual oriented in terms of learning and slowly absorbing what I hear by reading it.
Sure. Yeah, mine's written down as you know, so I can just put it on the listserv thing that we all have. Do you have access to that? Okay. So yeah, I'll put it there and you can read mine. Leah's yours in a format where you can share that way. I mean, everything's on video.
It's all recorded.
It's just again for me the way I process is, yeah, I like to read slowly and sit and think about things, so it would be helpful. So again, thank you very, very much. That was very deeply moving. Thank you.
Okay. We got time. 1 minute, Coral.
Oh, I just wanted to say, Scott, that on I think someone has dropped it in the chat as well, that if you go to the Brightway Zen website and you scroll down to precepts, Domio has shared also a list of books and texts that are for free that you can just access from the Brightway Zen website for
Yeah,
those who might be interested.
I did find those. I've been going through the Dharma Rain. Excuse me, Dharma Rain one that's like 37 pages or so.
Yeah, and thank you, Greg.
All right. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parami.